Welcome to From the Producer's Office, a series of informal podcasts with Opera Holland Park's Director of Opera, James Clutton. In conversation with creatives and collaborators, we explore the process of putting opera on stage and how the artists involved approach their craft.
Hello, welcome to From the Producer's Office. I'm James Clutton, Director of Opera at Opera Holland Park. Today I've got with me a wonderful guest, a great musician, a great conductor, someone who's been at the top of his game in this country for so long, Sir Mark Elder. Welcome, Mark.
James, it's lovely of you to invite me. Thank you.
Oh, it's great to see you. We'll talk about how we're both doing in a while because we've just had that chat before. But let's dive straight in and going right back to the very beginning. Was there classical music and opera around the house when you were very young and growing up?
Certainly not opera. My mother loved music and she loved Brahms. There were one or two records that she had, Toscanini conducting, I remember, the Brahms Second Piano Concerto, the Fourth Symphony. She loved Brahms more than anyone else, I think.
Yeah.
And my father wasn't really interested in that sort of music. He loved Glenn Miller.
Yeah.
They used to dance together when they were young.
I love it.
But I come from a very large family. I'm one of six children. And as a result, you can imagine that the noise level in the house was pretty considerable. And the record player and the space for doing games, Sibutio, yeah. Do you remember Sibutio?
Sibutio, yeah.
And the piano were all in the same room. So It was a bit of a traffic jam. But the place that music had in my life as an adolescent really started to grow in my teens.
Right.
Because of our local library.
Right.
I was brought up right in the middle of Crouch End, right by the clock tower.
Just down the road from where I am right now.
Right. Well, the sound of the clock tower striking was, you know, completely part of my childhood. And I would wake in the morning and hear the bells and know whether or not it was a foggy day or not, whether it was a pea super. Muffled and distant. I didn't have to look out of the window. I knew the fog would be, you know, would be terrible. Anyway, just off the centre of Crouch End, they built in the 60s the most wonderful library. Yeah. It's still there.
Yeah.
Behind the town hall, which is now nearly a hotel. And this library had incredible facilities, but above all, for me, it had the most amazing music section.
Right.
Really extraordinary.
Yeah.
And not only recordings, but sheet music as well.
Yeah.
And I remember there were holidays where I used to take my tickets in and get Il Trovatore out, and the next day go back and listen to Rigoletto, you know? Right. I went through the repertoire,
right,
much to the annoyance of some of my brothers and sisters. It was thrilling because I realised that this was something that appealed to me. This was something that might actually excite me and turn me on. Yeah. And I had no idea what the next step was, of course. But yeah, gradually I started to see these pieces, became a junior friend of Covent Garden with David Powell.
Yeah, yeah.
Go up to performances, you know. And I saw John Vickers do Radames. That was the first time I saw Aida.
Wow.
So it was a gradual process of coming to realise that there was this wonderful field of music out there, so different from the music that I'd sung as a boy. You see, I was a chorister.
Right.
And that's where the musical inspiration of my life started, when I was 8, 9, 10, 11.
Okay, great. And were you an instrumentalist as well, Mark?
Yes, I started the piano when I was 5, I think, and that sort of got me going on the theory of music.
Mm-hmm.
And we were taught theory again at choir school, but at choir school I started to play the bassoon.
Oh.
And when my parents bought me one, I don't know how they got it, but they bought me a French one. A French bassoon is different from the normal German system.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different instrument, really, different sound. So I started on the French bassoon and then went on to the German system, the Heckel system, a few years later, and started to play in orchestras, you know, youth orchestras. And that was an incredible experience for a young musician.
I'm sure. And when you were doing that, were you sitting in the orchestra looking at the conductors and thinking, that looks like a good thing to do? Or was that much, much later you started thinking about that?
Not much later. I joined the National Youth Orchestra for the last 2 years of Ruth Railton, the woman who founded it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some experienced conductors then, most of all, Rudolf Schwarz.
Yeah.
He was an amazing musician, amazing man, horribly abused and mutilated by the Nazis,
right,
who could only conduct from the elbows. He had no flexibility in his shoulders.
Right.
And Rudy conducted many performances with us. So we went on tour with him 2 summers. And I sensed watching him that there was something there that was interesting. I'd never seen anyone else do, not just physically, but in the way he communicated.
Right.
And it was about that time that I started to think about the role of the conductor, not for myself.
Mm-hmm.
It was too early. I think I started, as I left school and before I went up to university, I started to think about what was I going to do.
Yeah.
And I knew I didn't want to be a bassoonist, scraping reeds for the rest of your life. I mean, my heart goes out to them. These 2 little bits of bamboo, you know, never satisfied. I knew my piano playing wasn't good enough to be very professional in that way, although I did quite an amount of accompanying, coaching, that sort of thing. But I suddenly thought that perhaps I could be a conductor one day.
Right.
So that was quite late on in my teens, and then I started to conduct at university. I did an enormous amount of different things, different types of music, operas. First opera was there at Cambridge.
Mark, when you're saying you started at conducting at university, how did that actually come about? What was the moment you said, okay, I'm gonna do that? That's a big jump, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think one of the crucial moments was at the end of my first year. David Pountley and I were very close friends, although we were in different colleges. And we had this idea of putting on a show somehow. We didn't know what that meant. In the university student music group. And we had no idea what, you know, we were complete virgins. But I was leafing through the music library in the faculty, and I came across the score of a work by someone called Scarlatti. And then I realized it wasn't the guy who wrote all those sonatas, there was someone else.
Mm.
So I looked him up, Alessandro Scarlatti, 119 operas. And it turned out that I'd got the score of the only comic one. 115 or something it was, you know, and it was called Il Trionfo dell'Onore, the Triumph of Honor. And we made some inquiries, and it turned out that there was an English version and a complete edition of the score, because the score that I had was very bowdlerized. It was an Italian one, you know, from the 20s or something like that. It wasn't really critical at all.
Right.
So we said, well, come on, let's put it on. And David at that stage was just beginning to realize that he might be a director. He wanted to start feeling his way there. So we put the show on together in the university undergraduate theater.
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
And from scratch, you know, we cast it. I looked at the pit and thought, how few instruments can we afford to get in here, you know?
Brilliant.
And we spent the summer imagining how we would put it on. And that was the first time, really. At the same time, I was doing the odd concert. You see, in university life, there are many, many people who want to play and who are talented. They may be medical students or studying history, something like that, but they play. Right. And they want something to play in. And so the need for conductors to help organise undergraduate music is tremendous.
Yeah.
And after my first year, Andrew Davis and David Atherton had been conducting during my first year.
Wow, okay.
And they left, they disappeared. And a friend of mine came around one day, literally, he said, look, we need a conductor for next year, you know. There isn't that. Those two have gone. What? Why don't you do it? And I said, well, I couldn't do that. And this guy said, yeah, I'll help you. I'll help you organise it. We've got to organise everything, every concert, get the music, get the soloists, pull the undergraduates out of bed. And so he kicked me up the bum and said, get on with it.
Right.
And in those last 2 years at Cambridge, I did some amazing things. One concert, I remember, we did the Britain Serenade for tenor, horn and strings with the tenor, Kenneth Bowen.
Yeah.
And then I asked him, would he do Stravinsky's Oedipus Rex in the second half for the same fee? And he said, yes. That was sort of a mad thing you do at university. I remember David Wilcox, late lamented, you know, the master of music at King's College. He got in a 2-2 for one of my last concerts. Rouged his cheeks, got a wand, came tripping down with ballet tights.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So I sort of started the idea of conducting there. And I felt although, of course, I knew nothing about it and I was feeling my way, I was hopeless. But I felt, if I can say this, James, at home.
Yeah, right.
I felt that that's where I might do something, and it appealed to me. I'd acted a great deal all through my school days and college days. And the combination of all these things, I sang, you see, as a boy and as a teenager. And it all sort of started to come together, and I became riveted in opera, about what opera was and what it could be and how disappointing it very often was.
Right. OK. And that is amazing. And how did that show go with you and David, the first one? How was it?
Well, it was the most exciting thing that ever happened to me. Right. No doubt. It was more exciting than anything else that had happened.
Yeah.
And we did it. And we booked this theatre for a week, you know, so we got a couple of days rehearsals in there. And then we did, I can't remember now, three performances, did we? Friday, Saturday, Sunday, something like that. I can't remember now. And some of the singers went on to join us in the profession.
Right.
The baritone, Peter Knapp,
yeah,
was a tenor then.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he sang the Henpecked Old Husband. Anne Wilkins, who was at Covent Garden for many, many years, was in it. Yeah, it was lovely. And what was exciting about it was that we were forced to think differently, creatively. We had to invent a rehearsal. We had to invent the moves. We had to invent why we were doing it, what the opera's story was. We had to think about how to put it over. And I think for David and I, it was a very, well, it was a sort of crossroads moment, really.
It was great. Sounds absolutely incredible. You've always been, I know this, you know, from our conversations and from other people in the industry, a great mentor to young conductors, particularly when they're coming up. And Jonathan Haywood, we talked about a couple of years ago, who's a
conductor.
I mean, he's just been nominated for an RPS award. It's great. Yeah. And I've tried to get him a couple of times, but he's never free anymore. But you were mentoring him. Was there someone in that stage of your career then that was a mentor to you?
Well, yes. When I auditioned at Covent Garden, though, I think there were three people in the room auditioning us all. Hmm. Moment of sheer terror.
No, I'm sure.
And one of them was Edward Downes.
Right, okay.
And I, you know, I didn't know anything about him or, you know, the world at large. And they gave me a job at Covent Garden. And in my first season, I worked with Sholte on The Ring and immediately went and prompted Trovatore that Ted was conducting. And then a few months later, I prompted Rigoletto with Pavarotti that Ted was conducting. And I think Ted probably saw me and thought, I think I'm going to have to look after this guy.
Right.
And I think when he got to know me, I think what he said to me was that I reminded him of himself when he was my age.
Right. Okay.
And I think he wanted to help me. And I think he wanted to share things with me and see how we got on. Mm. And then during the rehearsals for that Rigoletto, he told me that he was the new music director of the Australian Opera Company.
Right.
And he was looking for some young repetiteurs who could go out to Australia for a couple of years with him and help the music staff and help the quality of the company and conduct.
Right.
Nobody, James, nobody in England was in a position to say that at that time.
Right, okay.
He'd say to me, come and join me, come and join our company or come and be a member here, and I promise you, you'll get a lot of performances. I'll give you some performances.
Wow.
No, say that. Kleinborn had expressed interest in trying to help me and bring me on. And I might have got a few performances by doing that. I'm sure I would. And I love Kleinborn and I wish I could conduct there more. But I went to Australia for 2.25 years and did 160 performances.
Wow. Fantastic.
So I owe that to Ted.
Yeah.
As part of that experience, he and I became very close. And he was there for as long as he could be, you know, weeks at a time. And then I would take the shows over.
Right, okay.
And it was an incredible experience for me to do this. Absolutely amazing.
I think the thing is that I always say about conductors is it's very difficult for conductors, particularly young conductors, to practice because it's all about getting in front of an orchestra or a choir or whoever you're conducting. It's the physical thing of doing it that's going to give you the experience and show you different skills and where you want to do things. And it's very difficult just to do that when you're on your own.
Absolutely. I mean, this whole concept of picking up a baton, looking in the bathroom mirror and practicing. Yeah. You know, I remember trying that once because everybody sort of teased me about it. Are you practicing in the mirror? And I thought it was so horrendous having to look at myself that I never did it again. No, you're right. All the instrumentalists practice like mad on the basics of making sounds, controlling, evaluating, judging their sounds and improving. Yeah. And until we get in front of a group of players, we can't begin to find out how the gesture affects the sound.
Yeah.
That for me started at university. And I did, you know, like a Handel concerto here and a Bart Brandenburg concerto there. Mm-hmm. And it gave me the ability to, I suppose the best way to say it is to realize what a huge mountain this was to climb.
Right.
And that it was only experience that was going to help me.
Yeah.
What Ted did was to provide me with this experience, to provide me with the opportunity to grow.
Yeah. And so it was over 100 performances.
160. I mean, it's amazing. Even if I'd gone to an opera house or two in Germany, I couldn't have had that.
No.
I lived with the company. We traveled all over the country, all over Australia. And one of the things that was most important to me about the experience was working and befriending a man who was as good as his word. Mm. And this is, it's rare. And everybody needs to have a few of these people when we're young.
Yeah.
He said to me, if you don't fall off the rostrum, and you don't make an idiot of yourself, pretty soon you'll find yourself conducting a couple of times a week. Come on. You know, because that's a ridiculous idea. Nobody did that. But he knew what the schedule was, and he knew who else might conduct. And the thing about Australia still today is that it's 12,000 miles away from London.
Yeah.
You're hundreds of miles away from Western operatic civilization, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't just ring up somebody and say, come and do La Boheme next week. Yeah. We need a conductor. So if you're a resident there and you're committed to being there, the chance is pretty great that, if you don't fall off the podium, you might do okay. And he was as good as his word.
Yeah, it is important. I find when I'm talking to young conductors and directors, actually, that I think that if they're doing a job for me, I often say to them, can you do a job next year again before the show opens? So it sort of instills a confidence, because I try to say to them, I'm not reliant on what everyone else thinks about what you've done. I'm trusting myself. I've seen you all through the rehearsal period. I've seen you in the build up to this, all your preparation. It could go wrong, of course, but I believe that it's not going to. But even if it does, you've got the job off me next year. And it just sort of adds a bit of extra confidence, and then they become a bit more open with it, and it's not that sort of tightness of nerves that can happen at different times.
It's very sharp of you, James, very thoughtful. You're absolutely right. What we all desperately need is to believe that the upbeat we're about to give isn't like the guillotine. You know, if it's wrong, okay, it's wrong.
Yeah.
Herbert von Karajan and George Schulte didn't always give perfect upbeats.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we have to learn how to survive and how to grow and how to develop. And we need to be very self-critical. But to have a feeling of confidence coming from our employer makes an amazing difference.
Yeah, I think so. And I also think that, because when people do get things wrong, and as we were talking just a moment ago about practicing, it's very difficult. And if you just continually stopped using people after a first time where it didn't go perfectly, you'd never have anyone else to employ. You know, you have to have a bit of a line of improvement, a line of where you want to go. And it was a few years ago when we started our young artist scheme, it was a thing I just absolutely thought we can develop people that we believe in and give them a bit of chance over a couple of years, rather than you've got to go into that show now, conduct it brilliantly, otherwise there's not another job for you. It just seems a very sort of short-sighted way of doing it, not only for the artists, but for the companies as well.
And I think if you do that, you will see in the second show whether or not you made the right choice. You will see whether they have the capacity to grow.
Yeah.
You know?
Completely agree. Let's whiz further on. You've already mentioned David Powney. We have to talk about E&O, the powerhouse he is with the two of you and Peter. That obviously gets looked upon now as the complete golden age of that great company. It's looked on in sort of amazement. When you, the three of you, were all doing it, did it feel like that then? Did you know you were in the middle of a time that people were going to be talking about, you know, whatever, 20, 30 years later?
Oh, no. No, of course not. We were struggling to keep the company afloat, like anybody who does that job will. And we had our disappointments and financial worries, you know, of an enormous scale, year after year after year, basically because the Arts Council were never in a position to tell us about the money far enough ahead.
Yeah.
So we would plan seasons and then have to go back on them, to renege on them. And yeah, that was really upsetting, letting friends and colleagues down.
Yeah.
And that was very hard. I think we all felt quite clear about one thing, that we wanted the company to be in a theatre in the middle of London that was exciting theatrically,
yeah,
that was wasn't going to necessarily always please the public, but for the 10 people who didn't like what we do, perhaps there would be 15 who loved it.
Yeah.
Perhaps there would be people who wouldn't want to come to the ENO before, but now they might give it a chance. And I think towards the end of the 80s, when there was a real feeling, because the Straight Theatre told us this, that people from the Straight Theatre were coming to the Coliseum to see what we were doing,
yeah,
and getting inspiration from it through the designers and the directors and the styles that we were coping with. I think then we felt that something was happening,
yeah,
that the company's work was contributing to the atmosphere of the nation's cultural life, if you like.
Yeah. I mean, it gets talked about so much. It's always this great period. And, you know, it's interesting to get your reaction then, because, of course, you must have had times where it didn't go well. But in retrospect, you look back on it now and everyone looks at it in sheer amazement, the sheer amount of performances that you got on stage and the breadth of work as well.
Yes, the breadth was important. And for me, it was very exciting to be able to attempt different styles in the pit, and to get the orchestra to develop their ability to play in different styles consciously.
Yeah.
And that started, you know, with Mozart and Handel. And thank God we had Charlie McGarris still there and his team of people helping. But, you know, Strauss and Verdi and Wagner are not the same. They mustn't sound the same.
Yeah.
And the Colosseum as a pit is not easy. It being very, very long and not quite deep enough.
Yeah.
And it means that the people who play at either end of the pit have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I always said I instituted the annual Christmas party to introduce the people at one end to the people at the other. And the orchestra, you know, gradually came with me. We had a tricky start because it was, I was very young and very inexperienced and a bit hot-headed, I think, probably. But I wanted the orchestra to be proud of themselves.
Yeah.
Wanted the company to realise that the orchestra was wonderful. Yeah. And that it could play brilliantly.
Yeah.
And the pieces that I did with them were designed to try and enhance their ability. Another aspect about the whole thing that was incredibly important at that time was how to make a sense of a company.
Yeah.
Because the idea of signing a contract for three seasons, like they do in Germany, you go over and you take a contract and you're fest for one season, two seasons, whatever it is, that couldn't work in London. And the singers that we wanted to work with, and you know who they are as well as I do, wouldn't ever sign a contract.
Yeah.
They would come and sing operas.
Yeah.
And so we sort of developed this idea of company artists, John Tomlinson, supreme example, Anne Murray, Philip Langridge, people who would come sometimes every season and do an opera. And they would be part of the family of ENO without being on the books.
Yeah.
That meant that the company singers were very few and far between, and casting some of the smaller roles was very arduous because they weren't automatically within the company.
Yeah, I think it's a model that that I very consciously have tried to emulate over the years at Holland Park, because I think that because we're only a seasonal company rather than a year round, but you still want to have that. So I do use a lot of the same artists. I do bring new artists in every year, but I bring use a lot of the same ones, because that sense of belonging and feeling and company, even though it isn't a company all year round, is really important, because there's a much stronger relationship between yourself as the management and the artist and the audiences, because the audiences see people develop. They see them, I saw so-and-so do that role, now I've seen them do that. There's a there's a much more shared experience, I think, as it goes through. And I've very openly tried to emulate that over the last few years, because I think that really works, what you all did then. I think it's a great way to move forward with the company.
Well, you've done something extraordinary, if I may say so, with your company, James. You've managed to entice, woo, and impress the public to such an extent that you can expand what you want to do and do it with confidence and knowing that the public will come with you. And that's a terrific achievement. And you've been steadfast. You've ploughed your furrow. And I think it's really, really remarkable, because it's a lot of seats to sell night after night in the port.
No, it's difficult. And you've always been a great supporter of ours and come into various things over the years. And it's always been greatly appreciated by me and the artists. But let's go back to you. It's lovely. It means a lot from you. So I'm a bit speechless of that. It means a lot from you. Let's go talk about more orchestral work rather than the opera work. Obviously, then in 99-ish, you went to the Halle, and you've been there since. You know, was that a conscious thing not to move from opera to orchestral music solely? Because obviously you haven't done that. But was that a conscious decision? You wanted to lead an orchestra at that point?
I had always, always wanted to have my own orchestra in my own country to make music for my people, you know, the people that would be there, not to fly in and out in a foreign country where I don't speak the language very well. I wanted to do it here in the United Kingdom. And I just didn't know whether that could ever happen, how it would happen when it did. And the stars seemed to gradually get into alignment. Mm-hmm. The Halle had a very, very difficult period. I believe actually since Barbara Olley died, really. The future of the Halle, I mean, it's interesting this, isn't it, James? You've had such a dynamic leader, so successful for such a long time. Mm. How do you go forward?
Yep.
In Birmingham, when Simon Rattle left, they were very clever. They found somebody who they all admired, who had nothing to do with the CBSO. He was completely unknown. And he came not so much as a fresh broom, but as a fresh spirit, fresh inspiration to them. Yeah. And it really worked. And I admired that enormously at the time. And I'm not sure that the Halle as an organization quite did that when Barbara Olley died, made the right decisions. So by the time we got to the end of last century, there were serious problems, financial and artistic, but also about the soul of the company, you know, soul of the orchestra. It's known, as you know, as the Halle Concert Society, which implies immediately that it's not just an orchestra.
Yeah.
And when I looked at the situation, it seemed to me that if I could find the right person to run it with me, and the finances could be made stable, which they weren't by the end of the 1990s. They were not stable. Okay. It might be just the opportunity that I was dreaming of.
Right.
And I was thrilled, and the orchestra seemed to welcome me. And we're still together, even now, goodness me, in these terribly difficult times.
Yeah, indeed.
And for me, it was a dream come true to be able to spend time rehearsing, for instance, the music of my country.
Yeah.
And recording it and doing it, you know.
You talked about then we're still together. It sounded like a marriage and a relationship. And of course it is when you've been with an orchestra that night. It's a genuine relationship, isn't it?
Yeah. And to sustain the very long time is not always possible, not always a good thing.
Yeah.
And some of my colleagues don't even try to do that. They go from one orchestra to another and only stay a few years. I've always been interested in the long haul.
Yeah.
In developing something like you're doing, the long haul, building something over a period of time, nurturing something, caring for it, caring for the individuals, and seeing where you can go together.
Yeah.
And I think that is the way an orchestra needs to be in the 21st century. It needs to be embedded in its community. Very, very large and rich and deep. It's not just Manchester. It's not just the whole of the Northwest. You know, we have a public in Nottingham. We have a public in many, many cities that are waiting.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And have you noticed that the audience changing in attitudes over that period of time, which is what, just over 20 years? Are they more open to different things you might program, or have you gone on a different journey with them across that time?
Well, we've certainly gone on quite a few different journeys. I think it's very important, you see, not to be too shy about stretching the repertoire.
Yeah.
For all the people who will write a letter and say, I wish you hadn't done that, there will be three people who are very glad we did it.
Yeah, indeed.
To something new. And music isn't the most go ahead of art forms when it comes to taking the audience with you.
Yeah.
People want to feel comfortable with what they know.
Yeah.
And that has always been the case. Barbarolli had exactly the same problems.
Right, okay.
You still have to go on stretching the audience and stretching the orchestra. And sometimes you'll do, you know, wonderful music that the audience doesn't really come to. Mm. And then you'll do something else when they really come. I mean, when we did Mahler 5, the students, 350 students, booked up 3 days before the concert. And the end of the concert was like a rock concert. You know, the students bring something so wonderful to it. So, you know, screaming and whistling, it's wonderful.
I think it's also, Mark, like your opinion on this, what I feel is that because we, you know, can be sensitive in different ways and in the arts, the one person rather than the three, the one person that writes saying they didn't like sits in your head for a longer time, or it makes more of a difference in an organization where it shouldn't do all the time. You should be able to get rid of that criticism and look at the people that have really been positive about it. But, you know, a bad complaint about something often stays with you a bit longer than a bit of praise.
Well, we're all sensitive human beings. And if you're going to be, you're going to spend your life expressing your feelings and not hiding them, then those feelings are going to be, feel a bit sore if somebody says they didn't appreciate what you did.
Yeah.
And all I would say to that is that in time, one learns to have broader and broader shoulders and they bounce off a little bit, you know, like the rain off the bonnet. And you have to remember that it's one person's view that moment in their life.
Yeah. I talk about it a lot. There was a famous, famous in our office, obviously not outside, but famous in our office that someone stopped me last season and said that they had really enjoyed the production that night. And I said, oh, great, thank you. And they said, we really didn't enjoy the one last night though. And I said, okay, well, I'm really sorry about that. That's a shame. And they said, and it was the second show of yours we haven't enjoyed in the last 6 years. And I said, oh, that's not too bad then. But they were really saying, no, that is bad. We haven't enjoyed two of your evenings. And we got into a nice chat. It was a very pleasant chat after a while, but I was saying really, two in 6 years of our seasons is not too bad. It's not too bad. You know, you just got to.
I completely agree. And they, you know, it shows that they're passionate about it there. It shows that they're engaged. And you take credit for that.
Yeah, we had a long chat about it in the end, but it just made me laugh in that because it was, you know, two consecutive nights at the theatre, seeing two of our productions, loved one, really didn't like the other one. Obviously, I'd prefer it if everyone liked everything, but when not, I'd rather they be passionate about it and say, well, I didn't like that one, but I really loved that one. It had a balance at least.
James, the thing about this is, which is difficult for our country, is that a theatre should be at the centre of a community.
Yeah.
It should be a place where things are debated and people, of course, don't agree, that they go there to find out whether they could agree. And there are some situations where this is the case. I mean, the Baltic states, when they had their revolutions, everybody flocked to the opera house in order to have a public meeting.
Right.
If you do a production in Munich, the extent of the audience participation and the criticisms are huge, and it's part of their lives. It's more central to their lives. And this is what being an artistically based person is all about, is trying to say something that people wish they could say, and you're trying to win them over with your point of view. And it can be life-changing. It can be so moving and so beautiful, and it can be horrendous if it doesn't quite touch the nerve ends.
No, I think you've always been great at trying to, you know, break down the wall between stage and the audiences in every way. I've seen you at concerts and opera things when you talk to the audience in between bits or at the end of the thing. And I think you always do it so well. And I didn't know until earlier in this chat that you acted a lot in your in your younger days, but I think that that really comes, your presentation is great because you just talk to these people in the audience about what you're doing, what we, you know, the one I saw last year at Operara was when you did La Villi's, and then you did some extra arias at the end after you explained it, and it just brought everyone in that auditorium with you about understanding what it is. And I think it's a, it's an amazing thing to be able to discuss things and break that barrier down, and so there aren't it. So it's everyone in that together, that complete shared experience of the artists and the audience having the having that experience at the same time. And you've always done that. Has that been a conscious decision of yours to talk to audiences when you can and try and break that down?
Yes, it has. I felt a long, long time ago that it was part of our responsibility as performing musicians to work at the development of a relationship with the public.
Yeah.
And I started to experiment with it when I was in charge of the orchestra in upstate New York, in Rochester, which is a very musical city. It has a very famous music school there, Eastman School of Music, and it has a marvelous orchestra. But it had at that time this enormous auditorium that wasn't very well looked after acoustically. Mm-hmm. And it was difficult to get large public. I mean, it was far too big for the community. And I thought, well, I should try and bring the audience in towards us. Mm. Because, you know, I've always been really clear in my mind that everybody has to understand that they don't need a university degree to understand a symphony. They just need to have an open heart.
Yeah.
And then they can take from it what they want to take. And that what they take is fine. If it's different from the person next door, doesn't matter at all.
Couldn't agree more.
You know, to have open attitude and an open feeling of enjoyment. And I expect that in Rochester there were people who thought I probably shouldn't be doing it, that they thought the hallowed silence was more appropriate. Mm-hmm. But there were, I know, the people who were very grateful that I did it, and I wasn't very good at it to begin with, but I've worked at it. I've tried to train myself and criticize myself about how to do it, how you can say what you want to say in the shortest possible time. And I think for the public, that the mere fact that the conductor turns around and shows his face to the audience and engages with them reminds everybody that the conductor is a go-between figure, that the way he communicates with the orchestra is the way the music comes over to the public, but that the conductor has a bigger responsibility to make everybody feel comfortable with different music. And it may be, particularly when we're doing a piece that you know people won't know, not that it's a modern piece necessarily, although it might be, just unfamiliar piece, then I think you can break the ice.
Well, I think it always works. And I think I've seen you do it so many times now, and it's just brilliant. It always works. I was also very fortunate. You and Henry Operara let me sit in on some of the recording sessions for that La Villi's, and it was a real privilege to see you conducting that in that situation and making a recording of it, and just that intimacy of recording and having to get every bar right because it's there, it's preserved, and I mean, it was just a sheer joy to see you do that, Mark.
It's lovely, isn't it?
It's really lovely. Well, we were due to be doing a version of it this summer, just gone. We, you know, obviously it was cancelled, so we're having to postpone it and bring it back later on. But lovely, lovely piece. Can I talk to you just more broadly? Do you think your conducting style has changed over the years? And is it something you consciously look at, or in the early days, were you trying to find the style, or did that just all come naturally? Because just intrigued to see how that happens with a conductor.
Well, the answer to that is that it happens with every conductor differently. Yes, I have constantly thought about what I do in relation to what I hear. Mm-hmm. And if I don't hear what I'm hoping to hear, I try and put the responsibility on me more than on the orchestra. If it's not quite together or it doesn't have quite the right feel, there must be something that I can do to make it better. And I think that if you can sustain that attitude as a conductor, it's a good way to grow. And I think my conducting style has definitely changed. I would be appalled if it hadn't over the years. But the other thing, James, that's very important to me is that your physicality changes depending on the music that you're doing.
Right.
And I've always been interested in that right from the beginning. What is it that makes a work sound idiomatic?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the conductor's role in that? And just to take two, examples, Rossini and Wagner.
Yeah.
You know, there they were writing music sort of at the same time, you know, in the first part of the 19th century. You can't possibly conduct them the same.
Yeah.
If you conduct Wagner like Rossini, it'll have too many hard edges. If you are brittle with it, and if you the tempi are too fast, and in Rossini the tempi need to be fast, they need to have a hard edge to them. There needs to be a crackling rhythm. Mm-hmm. In Wagner, it's not so much the rhythm as the way the pulse breathes, the pulse underneath the rhythm, the way that goes, like the ocean, you know, the swell in the ocean. And an orchestra has to feel that.
Yeah.
Okay, so you can't conduct Wagner with the same type of gestures. So you need to consciously think, how am I going to find the gestures to produce this sound? Mm. Now, I've been conducting Wagner for many, many years, and he's an incredibly important composer to me. I still adore his music. And it's very difficult to do well. Mm. But I remember, as I started to do it, realizing that I'd got to look at what I did. I'd got to start evaluating it and thinking, this isn't going to do it, because of what came back at me.
Right, right. It's a strange thing, and for people that at Holland Park, people talk about the conductors a lot, like it's more like a concert, because they're very visible, the conductors. They're not away in a pit. So you get a lot of people in our audience talking to the conductors or want to talk to them, because they can see not only them, but they can see all the musicians and how they react. And it's an interesting part of it all for me. Anyway, Mark, we're getting closer when we need to wrap up, but let's just talk about right now. How, you know, this is the worst question of 2020. How are you?
Well, I mean, I'm fine. 3 weeks ago, I had a terrible, terrible cold with masses of mucus that turned into a cough. Right. Just before I went up to Manchester to start working with the orchestra again.
Right.
So I went and paid an exorbitant sum of money to have myself tested in Harley Street to prove to the orchestra that despite the amount of coughing I was going to inflict on them, I was fine. It was a very, very expensive sort of, you know, reassurance.
Yeah.
And I've enjoyed in the first lockdown being around during the whole of the spring. It's something you see as a traveling musician. You just don't get the opportunity to do. Yeah. I've never seen our garden, which is not big, but it's lovely, go through the process of the spring breaking through the end of winter.
Yeah.
My wife Mandy and I have a granddaughter who in February will be two. So, this is a very big part of our lives, and our daughter and her husband live very nearby.
Yeah.
So we've been a bubble for a long time. And that's very special and really lovely. So that's helped the heart, you know, one's mood.
Indeed.
I think the whole business of not making music has been very, very difficult. It certainly affected my sleep patterns.
Okay. Still. Yeah, me too.
I'm not alone. And I just look forward to the time when one can do performances as a matter of course.
Yeah.
Now, in Manchester, we're just starting next week. We're going to do two concerts from our two halls, the Bridgewater and our new St. Pete's place, which is wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. James, you can come and see it. It's the most amazing place.
I'd love to.
And we're going to stream them.
Right.
And that will be an extraordinary experience for us all, not having made music together. And I try to look at the positives. I try to find everything positive I can in the situation. For instance, I don't spend any time thinking about all the music that I've had cancelled.
Yes.
It's crying spilt milk, isn't it? I mean, you want to just make a list and think, I mustn't forget that because I really want to do that. But yeah. not don't get blue.
Yeah.
And look forward to things which still may be cancelled. My next trip to America has just been cancelled.
Right.
You know, they're deciding about April already.
Right.
So I think you have to work at your own resilience.
I think that's absolutely right. I think it's difficult, though. I've spoken to a lot of singers, obviously, in this period, and you know, have been let down and slipped through the cracks of the support, really, the freelance musicians and singers. But also, as well as that absolutely practical thing, there's been just this gaping hole where they would normally be performing, and it just happens that their vocation is the same as their career. And their love, and so it's not only having their career taken away at the moment, it's what they love doing as well, and it's affecting people in lots of different ways, mentally and as well as the obvious things of physically and financially. It's affecting people in a very strange way, and you know, the cost of it will only really come out over the next couple of years, I think. But I just can't wait to get back and into a rehearsal room. For me, it's been Mark, actually. I've really missed the rehearsal room process of being in there, that collegiate thing of everyone being in a room, seeing the piece progress over a number of weeks and where it's going, and putting the bits of the jigsaw together. I really, really miss that in the summer. That was a big thing.
I completely agree, because the rhythm of that process has inhabited and inspired our daily life for so many years, James, hasn't it? That's the thing. And you want the next part of it to come, and you don't want to be cut back, you know, told you can't do it.
No.
Did you see that thing on that was very funny, that somebody had found a picture of Michael Gove and Boris Johnson in the House of Commons and had taken their heads off and put my head on Boris's and Simon's on Michael Gove at the time when they were saying it's time that musicians realise they've got to retrain and do something different?
I'm going to go and search for it now.
Leading brass players of our city admitted to me that he'd done it. He just made our heads fit the size of the bodies, you know, with Boris standing at the, you know, the Prime Minister's table in question time. The guy said, here we are doing responsible jobs.
Well, Mark, when you're going to stand, I'm going to go and vote for you. No worries about that. But Mark, it's lovely, lovely to speak to you as always. It's a real pleasure and a privilege for me to see you and talk to you today. And thanks for all your support personally and for our company over the years. It's been a great support.
No problem. And keep at it, you know, keep at it. I shall never forget coming, I think it was for the first time, and seeing the entire percussion section sitting there with umbrellas up. I thought, this is commitment.
It's Tristan Fry, you know. Well, absolutely. Thanks, so, Mark. See you in person soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have been listening to From the Producer's Office, a series of informal podcasts with James Clutton. For more information on Opera Holland Park, please visit www.operahollandpark.com.